The hour 10:15 having arrived, we will call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. The first bill we have up, and again, we do not have a quorum yet, but we will start to hear House File 706. I will move House File 706, the Miller bill. Members, you have a revenue estimate in your packets. I do not believe there's an amendment at all here. Okay, so welcome to the committee, sir. Before we get started, however, Representative Miller, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? Anyone that wishes to testify with concerns on this bill? Does the department wish to testify on this bill? Okay. So, Representative Miller, when we do have a quorum, I'll be moving your bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for this opportunity to meet with you concerning my bill, HF 706. This is a simple and straightforward bill intended to fix an unintended consequence of previous law. I'll be brief. In 2013, a new gift tax was signed into law that included a three-year look-back or clawback into estate taxes. When this bill was repealed in 2014, the three-year look-back was not. This was realized when a constituent of mine mailed me about a difficult situation in their family. I provided a copy of his letter, and I appreciate that he promoted me up to the federal level. So I spoke with Mr. Wilkening at length about his problem. And with his mom in a nursing home, they were facing a very unfortunate awkwardness of watching a calendar, hoping she lived long enough that this look-back clock would not expire. We should not be forcing people to live this way. In talking with tax experts, I was told that a three-year look-back was put into place so that a person with a terminal illness could not give everything away, while a person who died in a car accident did not have that fortune. So it was a fairness issue. While I disagree with the whole proposition, I can see where there may be an inequity there. So I'm asking, Mr. Chairman, that a compromise be set for a one-year look-back. 3 years is too long. Too many life changes happen in that span. I can tell you personally, in our family, in 3 years' time, my parents went from enjoying life and even traveling to both parents needing nursing home care and then passing away. So that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. I stand for questions.
Okay, any questions for members on House File 706? Okay, with that then, Representative Miller, when we have a quorum, I'll move it for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Item next, House File 751. There's Representative Keel here. Okay, item next, Representative Albright. I thought I saw him somewhere. Okay, Garofalo. Okay, I'll move when we have a quorum. I'll move House File 29. Okay, Representative Albright, members will go to when we have a quorum. Do we have a quorum? Okay, when we have a quorum, I will move House File 782, Technology Corporate 872, Technology Corporate Franchise Tax Certificate Transfer Program Established. Okay, welcome committee, sir. If you could please state your name. Well, I guess we know who you are. If you could please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 872 is a net operating loss initiative. Creates a tax credit marketplace. And if the page would come forward, I have a handout that I'd like to speak briefly to before we hand it over to the testifier.
Okay, if we have someone hand out the information here, please.
Thank you.
Okay, to your bill, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we live in a state where we are the benefactors of a number of emerging technology and biotechnology companies. And that being said, the gestational period and the growth of those organizations is sometimes halting, sometimes long and laborious at best. And with that being said, the insights and or the technologies that they provide can be very lucrative. It can be very beneficial to society as a whole. But in light of saying that, from time to time, it does require that patience is provided, but also capital. And what the NOL marketplace tax credit does is it provides an opportunity for those organizations of means to participate in the net operating loss carryforwards of emerging technology and biotechnology companies on an incentive basis, collaborating with those organizations to provide an infusion of capital at times when they most necessarily need it to offset the profitability of larger organizations. We are only talking about organizations that are emerging and are in their infancy. And as you see, take a look at the bill itself, you will note that there are a number of provisions that stipulate their domicile to be in the state of Minnesota, the number of employees that they are required to have or contain based upon the number, the amount of the NOL that they would like to request from DEED as the purveyor of the qualification standards. The handout that you have now before you, I just want to draw your attention to a couple points on here that I think are important to remind ourselves of as we walk through this bill. More funding allows growing companies to commercialize faster, becoming profitable and paying Minnesota taxes faster. We can only look to folks on the West Coast with the technology of that nature, as well as out on the East Coast with the medical ramifications of those institutions. We are the benefactors of a number of very, very successful organizations in this in state that will spin off other organizations that will have ideas that will benefit our tax base, and as you've heard before, a rising tide lifts all boats. And as you can see, the success that New Jersey as a state has realized from a similar tax credit for the years 2000 through 2004, or for 10 years as it is here, not only in terms of growth of employment, wage growth, but I think it's important to say that in terms of a return on investment, we are talking about a fiscal note, and you'll see that in your packet as well, but it is scalable. So this committee can certainly peg the amount of tax credits that they would like to offer to organizations of this nature. But in this case, over the course of 4 years, New Jersey's program cost a little over $202 million, for which they realized $1.3 billion in income tax revenues. Members, from a financial perspective, that is a worthy opportunity to realize good, sustainable, productive jobs, and well as an increase in the tax base, which also, in my opinion, would raise the profile for other venture capitals firms, as well as emerging technologies to be invited to this state, invited to the table for opportunities that they might see attractive to them as well. With that, I have an individual, Shane Mandel, that has expertise in this area. I'd like to turn it over to him for questions that you might have, as well as a presentation on methodology that we're embarking on.
Okay, and before we do that, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill with concerns on this bill?
Mr. Chair? I believe there is a gentleman from Revenue here to speak to the slide deck that he has presented.
Yes, that was my next question. The department will testify on this bill. Okay, very good. Okay, please state your name and who represents for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shay Mandel. I'm president and CEO of Life Science Alley. And you know, this is a bill that we've been working with the department, with all of you on, for a couple of years. It is complicated tax policy, and I'm happy to get into those issues, but let me just sort of set the stage for why this is really important for Minnesota. This July 1st, the American History Museum of the Smithsonian is opening a new exhibit called Places of Invention, and it chronicles the latter half of the last century and those great places of invention here in the United States. It includes Silicon Valley in the 70s. It includes...
Excuse me, sir. Yep. We do have a quorum. I'm officially going to call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Simonson moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simonson. I will move House File 706, the Miller Bill we just heard, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Now I will move House File 872. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition to Silicon Valley, this exhibit recognizes Hollywood. It recognizes the rise of hip-hop from the Bronx. And perhaps most importantly for all of us, it recognizes Medical Alley in Minnesota. Now, that exhibit looks at the innovators, the inventors, the way in which this community, through the University of Minnesota, partnership with Earl Bakken, changed the way we treat and care for people in this country. But back then, it was 48 hours from the time that Dr. Lilahi needed help and Earl Bakken was able to provide it. Today, the world looks very, very different. Today, the cost and time that it requires to put a new therapy in the marketplace to save people's lives is 5, 7, 10 years. So back when Minnesota was recognized for being the great place of innovation, there was no FDA. Venture capital happened locally, and today that world is significantly different. We have the greatest concentration, the most densely concentrated medical technology cluster in the entire world. We have the fastest growing biopharma and biotech community in the world. And as healthcare continues to change, Minnesota has a real opportunity in the next 5 years to ensure that our history, that our legacy continues, that it's not just our past and our present, but it is our future. And in order to make sure we do that, we've been looking at unique and creative ways to take advantage of this unique and creative industry that is headquartered here in Minnesota. What this bill allows is for those companies whose business plan requires them to lose money for a significant period of time to put those losses to good use. So again, we always get the question, isn't this propping up bad businesses? You know, how do we reward companies that lose money? Every business plan today for a new medical technology, a new biotechnology, a new pharmaceutical company looks at a 5 to 7 year window of time. It requires $50, $100, $200 million of investment. And there's no way to become profitable until there's a product in the marketplace. What this allows those companies to do is surrender those net operating losses, capture cash, which allows them to accelerate or deal with challenges, whether it's FDA, clinical trials, hiring another engineer, etc. And the great news is once these companies are profitable, they've surrendered their NOLs and become taxpayers much more quickly than they otherwise would have. And again, I would just draw everyone's attention to 10-year study in New Jersey, which again, their pharmaceutical industry is a unique industry like ours, and so it is a great measurement tool. And over a 10-year period of time, the state saw tremendous job growth, the creation of new companies, and ultimately the state made money that the taxes that were created as a result of those companies and jobs far exceeded the credits that were let by the state. And so, again, with that, I'm happy to answer questions and help the committee through this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel. Why don't we bring the department down, and if Mr. Mandel, if you could kind of stick around here in case members have questions, if we could have the department come down and make a few comments. Doesn't have to be a few comments. It can be all the comments you'd like. It would be fine. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
So I am going to just... here we go.
Bless you.
Thank you for your testimony.
How was that, Mr. Chair?
Short and sweet and to the point. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, I am here with Mr. John O'Mahony, an attorney in our Legal Services Division. If it would be helpful to the committee, Mr. O'Mahony will walk us through a brief background of net operating losses, the history of loss trafficking, federal legislation on net operating losses, and a comparison between Minnesota and New Jersey.
Mr. Cummings, did you say lost trafficking?
Mr. Chair, I did. And Mr. Chair, and I think one of the reasons why I said lost trafficking is there was a point in time in which net operating losses was not as well regulated, in which lost trafficking would be a very good way of describing this, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Please proceed. I apologize.
Mr. O'Mahony will provide this background, and then I will close with some closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. And members, you should have the slides that should be passed out to you here so you can kind of follow along here. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John O'Mahony. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. In the interest of fully informed decision-making, we now bring you some points about esoteric tax policy. So I apologize to the extent that some of this is somewhat complicated, but we do think that it's helpful in terms of understanding exactly what's being proposed. I want to start from a very basic level. I mean, not to talk down to the committee, but just to go over the very specifics of what a net operating loss is. A net operating loss occurs in any given year when a business generates more losses than it does taxable income. Now, if you cut that off at 12 months, it has rather drastic consequences of leaving those losses unutilized. That is how the system worked from 13 to 18. In 1918, Congress changed that for the first time, allowing a one-year carry back and one-year carry forward. That was originally intended as a war effort stimulus, but turned out to be a pretty good idea, so it has continued all the way through today. Now, the problem that you have when you start to allow people to carry operating losses backwards and forwards is companies that have losses would really like to be able to get rid of them, and companies that have income would really like to be able to get a hold of losses. And so from a very early point in time, there was always a very hyper-formal rule in the code that only a company generating a loss would be able to utilize that loss to offset income. The first time that you have this issue percolate to the United States Supreme Court was in 1934 in the New Colonial Ice decision. In that decision, the court made the rule that the requirement was, in fact, hyperformal, and a change basically in name only was too much for a loss to be offset by a different company. The Internal Revenue Code was overhauled a little bit in 1939, and these restrictions were loosened a little bit to allow losses to be carried between different companies in certain reorganization situations. The next time you see this issue percolate to the U.S. Supreme Court is in 1957 in the Lipson Shop decision. In that decision, the Supreme Court said, okay, Congress, we understand what your concerns are about getting losses from one company to another in situations where that would be equitable. So the new rule is going to be that we will allow losses to be trafficked from one company to another, but only to offset income that is generated by the exact same business activity as the activity that generated the losses. This is a quote from Lipson Shop that I won't read to you, but I think is a pretty good demonstration of net operating loss carryover and how those can be taken between companies then and now. In 1954, Congress actually, and this is a funny story, if you go read it in the BNA portfolio, they don't have a footnote to explain this, but apparently there were some newspaper articles in the Washington Post that advertised the concept of buying companies that were filled with net operating losses and how you could use those to offset income and how this was really an effective business strategy. Congress was disturbed by this, and so they passed some new laws in the 54 code overhaul, and that's where you see the original sections 381 and 382, which limit loss carryover being trafficked between companies. Today, those particular provisions were not very successful. The IRS was never able to successfully promulgate regulations under the original section 382, and it was completely changed in the 1986 code overhaul, which gave rise to the modern section 382 limitation, which is what we have today. The reason that I want to talk to you about the section 382 limitation, and this is somewhat different than the legislation being proposed by the gentlemen who are here today, is because the 382 limitation is what today is used to stop taxpayers from being able to purchase companies that are filled with losses to offset income in a way that would not be economically fair. What is being proposed to you is somewhat different, and I want to be clear about that. That what is being proposed is just the monetization of those tax losses being passed from one company to another. It would not be necessary to actually purchase the company, which is currently the only way that you can get losses out of a company. I apologize for that digression. I want to explain to you how the modern Section 382 limitation works. This is kind of technical, but it is important, especially in one way that I want to compare Minnesota's proposal to what currently exists in New Jersey. The Section 382 limitation is a limitation on the amount of income that you can offset with losses in a company that you buy. The way that the limitation works is you take the value of the company at the time that you buy it, so a loss corporation, and you multiply that by the IRS long-term rate. That is the maximum amount of loss that you can carry over from one company into a company that you buy. Now, to get into just a little bit of technical minutia, but this is important, the limitation is kicked in any time that there is a change in ownership of a loss corporation. A loss corporation is a company that has net operating loss carryforwards as of January 1st, and a change in ownership takes place when any group of 5% shareholders takes over more than 50% of a particular company. Now I just want to talk to you a little bit about some differences between net operating loss law in Minnesota and New Jersey. First of all, Minnesota adopts the federal definition of a net operating loss. New Jersey does not. They never have. They define it independently for state purposes, and New Jersey net operating losses function somewhat differently than Minnesota net operating losses do. Minnesota law adopts the IRS modern Section 382 limitation and allows for all losses to be carried between companies that would be allowed at the federal level. New Jersey law is much more harsh on this topic. New Jersey disallows all net operating losses following any 50% ownership change of a business if there is a change in the trader business. This is a more formal requirement that echoes the logic behind the Lipson Shop decision that I was talking to you about earlier. New Jersey also disallows all net operating losses when an entity is acquired for the purposes of absorbing tax attributes. That's not something that's ever been on the books in Minnesota, although it is in federal law. New Jersey also disallows all net operating losses when a corporation changes its state of incorporation. This is a very formal requirement, and it really harkens back to the logic behind the New Colonial Ice decision from all the way back in 1934, much more restricted than anything you would see in Minnesota. New Jersey law also disallows all net operating losses following a merger, except for losses of the surviving company that were generated before the merger. Again, this is Lipson Shop. It's a very formal requirement, and it's not something that happens to companies in Minnesota. A final point of comparison is that in New Jersey, net operating losses can only be carried forward by a company for a period of 7 years. We were talking about that period of initial investment, and so that is perhaaps a very important point in New Jersey. In Minnesota, they can be carried over for a period of 15 years. I want to bring you one point of comparison, and I've lost anybody's attention, or if anybody has kind of faded out, I would like to emphasize this because I think it's important. The Minnesota proposal, well, I'll start with New Jersey. New Jersey has a rule that applies in this system that prohibits a company who is purchasing losses from doing so if they're a 5% owner of the company that they're purchasing the losses from. The proposal before you in Minnesota does not contain a similar restriction, and the reason that that's important is because in Minnesota, a company would be able to purchase losses from a company selling them when they would be prohibited from taking those losses by Section 382 at the federal level and kind of end around that limitation. That is currently not allowed in New Jersey. Final points of comparison here. The Minnesota proposal requires a 75% tax benefit utilization rate, where in New Jersey's is 80. There's also a $2,500 application fee for the program in New Jersey, and there's somewhat more specific requirements for document disclosure and substantiation than in the current proposal. The reason that this is important and the reason that we have decided to try and give you some context today is because we would like to emphasize that federal legislation governing the trafficking of losses is well developed and has been carefully thought out over a long period of time. Since the inception of net operating loss carryover provisions, federal authorities have recognized the need for anti-loss trafficking rules, and those have been developed at the executive, judicial, and legislative levels. The proposed law will allow corporations, finally, to utilize net operating losses that they are currently prohibited from claiming because of the federal Section 382 limitation, and that is a major difference between this proposal and what currently exists in New Jersey, and we want you to be aware of that. I'd like to thank you all very much for your time and attention, and I'll cede the floor back to Mr. Cummings at this time.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair.
Oh.
Chair, we appreciate the opportunity to provide some context about this provision. Net operating losses play an important role in our tax code, and we appreciate the time you're spending this morning discussing these tax attributes. This legislation would bring us out of compliance with the federal tax code because New Jersey has stringent policies on net operating losses, more stringent than the federal government. This policy may make more sense there. Our policies on NOLs align with the federal tax code and allow for greater fluidity. Net operating losses, as articulated under Lipson, were meant to soften the impact from year to year. This may change the nature of this into a monetized taxed attribute. New Jersey currently has a strong economic substance doctrine, where Minnesota currently lacks that. If Minnesota were to be serious about monetizing these tax attributes without incentivizing transactions that do not serve a business purpose, then it may not make sense in a state without a strong economic substance doctrine. An economic substance doctrine would restrict transactions or organizational structures that do not serve a business purpose but only to serve to avoid or evade taxes. If the state is trying to give money to companies that have not yet turned a profit, then a possible logical next step would be to make net operating losses refundable, which is not quite the purpose of NOLs as articulated under Lipson. All of these factors could substantially change the incentive in setting up and running companies. The tax code, rather than the economy, would be a strong incentive to stack losses or to buy these types of corporations, which I think would be an unintended result. We think that if it's the desire of the legislature to invest in these type of emerging biotech firms, it may make more sense to have a program that is set up through deed. Mr. Chair, we're happy to be a resource on this bill. We look forward to continuing working with you, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, as this bill and other important bills move through the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Questions for Mr. Mandel, Mr. O'Mahony, or Mr. Cummings, or the author from members? I think we've seen this one before. Questions? Okay, with that, I will move House File 872 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Thank you, everyone. Representative Keel, item next, members. House File, I will move House File 751. Next on our agenda, are there any amendments here? You have a revenue estimate and you have a fiscal note, both provided here. Welcome to the committee. Again, I will move House File 751. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 751 is a tax credit for workforce development and a job training tax credit. And just a way to help our businesses. But in light of that, I know you have a busy schedule today, and I'm going to ask Mr. Seifert to help us. And then I have a gentleman from Owatonna here to talk about it, too.
Thank you very much. But first of all, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of House File 751? Anyone that wishes to testify with concerns? Is the department interested in testifying on this bill? I guess we'll come back to that.
I don't think so.
Okay, welcome, committee. Sir, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marty Seifert. I represent the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Keel and the committee for working on this bill. Mr. Chair, members, House File 751 is what I would call a companion bill with House File 750, which is a grant program. This one, as you know, has tax implications with the tax credit. It is loosely modeled after a pilot program that DEED started last year that was targeted at training people in greater Minnesota that gave the businesses more flexibility and speed as compared to what they have with some of the other job training programs that are out there. The first grant announcement came last year in October 21st. A welding business in Sauk Rapids was awarded $50,000. C4 Welding, Edmonton Trailer and Sartell was awarded $50,000, and Talon Innovations $44,000. These are for usually highly specialized rural businesses that oftentimes cannot wait for higher education, although higher education is eligible to deliver this under MinSCU or the U of M. In some cases, they cannot offer these types of programs. An example is C4 Welding. They're a fabricator and assembler of welded components for nuclear industry. In many cases, we don't have the programs in MinSCU for things like nuclear welding of those particular components. So what this program does is it allows a business to take advantage of a private skilled trainer to come in. In this case, they added 17 new welding positions. They didn't have to wait for the semester to start. They didn't have to shop around and try to find a higher ed institution that may or may not offer the program. They were able to find a private business, if you will, one which is located in Owatonna, and I'll turn over to Mayor Coons to talk about this a little bit, where they can get in quickly, immediately, with a minimum amount of bureaucracy, get their workers trained, and get them back to work. In many cases, we're looking for the but-for test, which is if we are not able to have these workers trained on-site and in Minnesota, they may outsource these components to be welded and fabricated in Milwaukee or Chicago because there simply are not training programs in Minnesota. And so what we're trying to do is keep the jobs here in Minnesota, be fast, be flexible, and be affordable in regard to doing it. We do have some what I would call safeguards that were analyzed by Representative Gunther's committee and Representative Garofalo's committee. You must pay the median county wage, so there is, that's usually a question we get from members, is will this, these just be minimum wage jobs? The answer is no. You must have 32 hours per week. It is not, you are disallowed from being able to permanently train people because of a labor dispute. So there are some various what I would call comfort languages for members on both sides that we've worked through the process. We did meet with the deed department, Mr. Chair, and we plan on fashioning some language before your omnibus bill comes up that would deal with capping the amount that would be available in the credit, so it would not just be open-ended.
Okay.
Right now the maximum is 50% of the training costs. So with that, that's a brief overview. I can turn over to Mayor Coons from Owatonna, if you wish.
Home of the Mighty Huskies?
Home of the Mighty Huskies. You got it. Yes.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mayor Tom Coons, City of Owatonna, Minnesota. Mr. Chair, committee members, Mr. Petersburg, it's a pleasure to be able to be here. You know, Owatonna has got the privilege of having a great industry base. And with that industry base, jobs and job training is very, very important. If you look at ViroCon, it has 1,500 employees, and the list goes on. You know, one of the problems that we have is with our school system not taking care of the vocational training or the trades that used to be there now, but more and more difficult to be able to get that training for those workers to be able to start up in their factories and everything. And so it's either vocational schools or private industry or the factory themselves that provide this training. And in order to do that, we need some tax credits to be able to offset that. A couple of prime examples of vocational training that's important is, stopped at my bagel shop the other day, and his son is going to become a carpenter, and he is going to vocational school to do that. He had his vocational carpenter shirt on, and he went to the Mall of America. During the time he was at the Mall of America, he had three people come up and ask him, do you want a job? We need carpenters. So that vocational training is very, very important. We had another one that has just joined our church, and his son is going to become a machinist. It's his first year of going to school. Cybex hired him as a tool crib employee in order to get him secured when he finishes machining to come into the factory. So it's very, very important that we provide these trainings and look for these tax credits to have the industry provide that training for these skilled jobs.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for the author, Mr. Seifert, or Mr. Kuntz from the committee? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Seifert or whoever would like to answer. I'm really kind of surprised by the provisions in line 1.23 that provides that you have to work at least 32 hours per week for a minimum of 9 months of the year. And is permanent with no planned termination date. And, you know, at best, that's a school district part-time job. You wouldn't even be working more than a half-time when you figure out the three-quarters of a year and about three-quarters of a normal full-time work schedule. And what is that provision designed for as opposed to people getting full-time year-round employment?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, we wanted to provide at least some benchmarks or some minimal floor in place of at least 32 hours per week. Our intention is really that these will be utilized by full-time employees. The pilot programs were targeted for full-time employment, and we certainly would be open if committee members wanted to raise that. In some cases with fabrication and machinists and welding, they can't give a guarantee of 40 hours. They sometimes have ups and downs. Representative Anzalks probably knows that more than anything, that in many cases there's a scalability of employment that we don't want to punish the employees or the employers because there may be a ramp up or a ramp down of employment during the year. And so we thought 32 hours made sense and reflected a lot of what the federal government is going to on definitions as well.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This actually has an and. And so that means that's 32 hours a week for minimum of 9 months, so that you would actually qualify for this if you worked basically between, you know, half and three quarters time on a permanent basis, which is really not enough to support most people, particularly when you're talking about the average county wage in an area. And I, you know, the description of what you're proposing doesn't sound like you really intend to have people working part-time or only seasonal and having a quarter of the year in which they don't have a paycheck. But, you know, to subsidize the training of someone for a job that won't allow them to meet their rent year-round, to me, you know, is really a question. And so I think we should really look into that further because that really isn't the kind of training result I think we want to see from a tax investment. The other thing I'd like to say is, you know, we had the One Minnesota Conference in which all the House and Senate members are traditionally invited to the Humphrey School to listen to experts about our economy, about how we compare to other states. And this year we heard from our state economists, Ms. Columbakidis, along with someone at the University of Minnesota who has actually studied Greater Minnesota's economy, and I think she had 9 different regions. She went through each one, what their strengths, what their weaknesses were, and one of the things that was really striking there was that the regional centers in Greater Minnesota, many of them have the fastest growing economies in the state, and they have less unemployment than the metro area. And that's true in the metro area as well. I mean, you can go to certain fast-growing exurban suburbs, and they are just booming, and they're recruiting people at the Mall of America, as the testimony said. We have other parts of the metro area where they have tons of industrial and commercial vacant property, employers who are struggling to find trained workers. And I'm wondering why we aren't targeting this to the portions of Greater Minnesota and perhaps other parts of the state that really have the need for assistance in growth, as opposed to the areas that actually have the fastest growing economies in the state.
Mr. Seifert.
Thank you, Chairman Davids, Representative Loeffler. Our goal would be to have this program utilized in anywhere we think it's possible. And in some cases, we have a boom and bust economy in rural Minnesota where things are humming along, and then all of a sudden we have a massive layoff or a change. And that's really what I think the program is aimed at, is quickly getting people trained and back to work and paying taxes and providing for their families. One example that I did not mention was the pilot program in Crow Wing County that was announced for Magnum Machining in Deerwood and Ironton, Minnesota, which it currently employs 59 workers. The pilot program under this training would provide for 20 new machinist jobs. You know, technically that area may have an okay unemployment situation, but there may be people in that Deerwood-Ironton area that might be moving from an area to the north that need the training. So it's really difficult to target it to a particular area because of, we analyzed this a little bit, because you may have people moving from two counties away who experience layoff and they'd like to get trained and not necessarily move to the metropolitan area or a large regional center. So the program was based after the pilot program that was targeted only for rural Minnesota. One of the qualifications the target program had, the pilot program had, that we don't have in the bill is that it was only capped. It was capped at 150 full-time employees, and we felt that we wanted to give a little more flexibility. If a business has 160 employees, they want to add 25 more. We didn't want to punish them for doing that.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, this is just a, I think, a priority choice that we're going to have to make as to whether or not we're going to give tax breaks to businesses that need, that want to train their workers on site, and whether we should do it in a way that's targeted to allow growth where we really need, in parts of our state economy that needs growth, as opposed to areas where they have easy access to technical colleges and Minsky campuses and other training opportunities that maybe a deep rural community doesn't have, or it would be a sacrifice to try and commute to that campus. And I think the same thing is true of the metro area. We have boom and bust. We have, you know, 2,000 employees who were left off, laid off from one of our major corporations, and I can tell you they're not all going to get hired back into the work that they were hired in. And it, the layoffs weren't just the people at the in the nice offices with the big salaries. There are a lot of people at other levels who would love to have an opportunity to be trained into a good paying job. And so I think we're just best served if we're going to use the tax code, and I'm not sure that that's the best, most efficient route, but if we were going to use the tax code to really target it to the parts of our state economy that really needs some extra help and isn't near a Minsky campus.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. For the record, did the department wish to make comments on this bill at all?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. We don't have any comments at this time. I did speak with Representative Keel, and we'll continue to work with them. I know as the author and the representatives work with the Department of Economic Development, we would appreciate being as part of those conversations. I know that there's many audit functions in this that we would want to make sure are clear so that we can best administer this if it's something that moves forward.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. To the mayor and then to Representative Ansells. The mayor had a comment here.
I do. I use Virocon as an example. You know, we talk about we have a robust economy and we're in rural Minnesota and not everybody has that privilege. But we have a challenge trying to keep those companies in Minnesota and not having them go overseas or go to another state. When we worked with Virocon, they had the opportunity to go to Georgia, they had the opportunity to go to Utah, but it was only through DEED and some of the programs that were out there and workforce training that was able to keep those companies in Minnesota.
And Mary, Owatonna is more than Virocon. Owatonna is quite a town. Do you still have, is Wagner still there?
Wagner's, Wanger Corporation is there, Cybex is there, Bosch Industries there.
Gandy, are they still around? Or
Gandy Company is now Amatec. They're still there. Yes.
Okay.
So we have a very diverse industry base.
Used to have Jerry's Supper Club and the Open Hearth, but I don't think they're there anymore, are they?
They have both gone along the wayside.
They have. Boy, they were good. Whew. Okay. Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, just to bring a little balance to the discussion here, if you live in greater Minnesota, you don't need a study to tell you that your economy needs A, diversification, B, trained workers, and C, entrepreneurs. And whether you are struggling with retaining jobs and businesses, and that struggle is difficult because of retention of workers and finding skilled workers, or if you're trying to attract a diversified economy to your region, you got to have a labor force. And we don't have one. Plain and simple. We do not have the skilled workers necessary for the jobs that are there or we would like to have there. One other comment. The Minscu system, and especially the community college system and vocational systems, do an adequate job. But without customized skilled training, it really doesn't work fast enough for employers. So I don't know how this is going to fit in the overall scheme of things, but conceptually, members, this is a good thing for Greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Ansel. Any other questions or comments from members? Okay, with that, I want to thank Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, sorry to join you a little late, but was working on a little project called Targets, and just want to comment tonight. The Ways and Means Committee will be adopting Targets, and it's now public. There was a press conference by both caucuses, but what I'm picking up on, you referenced, I'm sorry I came in late, so I'm not sure what the name of the gentleman here is, Mr. Chairman.
Mayor Tom Kuntz, City of Owatonna, Minnesota.
Okay, and Mayor, you referenced things that were a positive development working with DEED, and that particular budget item tonight is going to be cut significantly by over almost, 20.5 million will be the cuts in that job development area. Now, I know this is a tax credit that's before us, and that's a different question, but I only point that out because you referenced the good things that came out of working with DEED, and also, as Rep. Van Zout pointed out, we know what's needed around the state when it comes to job development, but that'll be up tonight. And the way things operate, even if we come up with an alternative, I suspect it will perhaps fall on deaf ears, but we will be probably making some attempts. That's more a comment than a question, Mr. Chairman, but I'm not sure everybody's aware of what's happening with some of these accounts. And we just heard testimony that one of them in particular had some positive outcomes.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Any other questions regarding this bill? If not, I will move House File 751 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you to the Mayor of Owatonna, Mr. Seifert, mm-hmm. and Representative Keel.
Thank you.
Item next, House File 182, Garofalo.
What taxes?
Chair Garofalo moves House File 182.
This is not blocked. This is their political document. Spending 39.
This is a two-tier compressed natural gas tax rate. Chair Garofalo, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. What this is a compressed natural gas tax rate change. Currently, compressed natural gas, for those that don't know, compressed natural gas is actually in a gas form, not a liquid. And so, therefore, there are different ways to calculate the taxes on it versus a liquid. What this does is it makes it a more technically accurate measurement. You'll find in your note a revenue note.
Based on February.
Although there is some discrepancy of what that revenue this is also in the governor's bill, but apparently there is some conflict about what the actual revenue amount is, but it should be a pretty small amount. Again, this is a proposal that's is included in the governor's budget, and I'm happy to have with me expert testifier to elaborate on this proposal.
Okay, and before we do that, I'd like to ask if there's anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of House File 182. Anyone with Okay, four. Okay. Why don't you join us? We'll go to Mr. DeLaForest first, and then Mr. Carnival. Anyone else wish to testify on behalf of this bill?
Mr. Cummins is going to.
Anyone wishes? No, you're a whole separate entity, Mr. Cummins. You're the department. Anyone wish to testify with concerns on this bill? Okay, and then the department wishes to testify. So we'll go through this testimony, and then Mr. Cummins will bring you down, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. I believe it's still morning. Chris DeLaForest, representing Ace Solid Waste.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you. Always nice to be back. As an alumnus of the House Taxes Committee, I'm always happy to be back. Mr. Chairman, recognizing that no one's here to testify against House File 182, that will inform the length of my testimony here this morning. But although the bill may appear modest on its face, it's very, very important to the waste hauling industry, and that's why Mr. Carnival and I are here. The waste hauling industry is an industry in which running vehicles on compressed natural gas and not diesel anymore, that future is really here today. Every day vehicles are converting over to compressed natural gas. So this bill is important for two reasons. One, it introduces a measure of tax conformity in between the state and the federal revenue codes, which obviously creates ease of administration for the many accountants we all have to employ to deal with things like this. Second, and perhaps more importantly, is that right now there is a market distortion in favor of diesel fuel. So if you have two garbage truck side by side in the yard, like at Lakeville Sanitation here this morning, you fill up that one truck with diesel, you fill up the other one with compressed natural gas, you will pay more, that hauler will pay more for the compressed natural gas at the state tax level. And so what this bill does, even though the number is rather modest, it removes that distortion and puts at least a level playing field for compressed natural gas and diesel to compete on. And so that's vitally important for the folks I represent. I would add one other thing to that, too, that runs beyond just the use of compressed natural gas. What makes at least putting the two on a level playing field important is there can be significant capital costs as well. Just to give you an idea, ACE, which is a mid-sized hauler, we have probably about 80 or so employees, to run natural gas into our facility. We don't buy it at retail. So to create that fueling facility for the couple dozen trucks that we have, that was almost a $2 million capital outlay. We will recover that even with the depressed oil prices, but nonetheless, you can appreciate that this conversion to compressed natural gas can be a significant outlay. And so on behalf of at least the haulers I represent, and Mr. Carnival is here to speak for the association as well, we think removing that market distortion is good public policy.
Thank you, Mr. DeLaForest. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Well, thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, Doug Carnival, McGrand Shea Carnival Law Firm, representing the Minnesota chapter of the National Waste and Recycling Association.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The waste and recycling industry has more heavy-duty compressed natural gas trucks than any other industry in the United States except buses. Our industry has been a leader in the purchase of natural gas trucks and the installation of compressed natural gas fueling stations, and is the fastest growing segment among heavy duty trucks. Our members in Minnesota have 174 trucks and 6 fueling stations located in the metropolitan area. The hub and spoke nature of waste and recycling collection vehicles works well with our trucks returning to their home base at night and being able to refuel before the next day. CNG trucks are expensive, as Mr. DeLaForest mentioned. Typical recycling truck costs about $300,000, with the CNG truck being about $30,000 more than that. Typical fueling station, depending on existing retrofits such as maintenance bays and trucks, four trucks rather, can cost anywhere from $2 to $4 million, as Mr. DeLaForest mentioned. Adding additional expenses are incurred with training mechanics and drivers so they have the expertise to work on and drive these vehicles. Despite these expenses, these trucks are easier to maintain, are quieter and cleaner. For example, greenhouse gas emissions are reduced by 21% over standard diesel engines, and if the CNG gas is derived from landfill gas versus standard pipeline CNG, the greenhouse gases can be reduced by an astounding 90%. Yet the compressed natural gas tax rate is higher than the gasoline equivalent and the diesel gallon equivalent. Our industry supports this legislation because it removes the CNG penalty and eliminates market distortion in favor of diesel. This legislation will provide a level playing field with regard to fuel taxation. This bill makes environmental sense and we appreciate the bipartisan support to remove an impediment to that change and advance the implementation of this renewable fuel. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carnival. Before we go to questions, let's bring the department down, if we could, for some comments. And Mr. Carnival, if you can stick around here.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, the administration and the Department of Revenue supports this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource.
We have that on table.
Mr. Chairman, that's some A-grade testimony right there.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings, for that testimony. Any questions for members for Mr. DeLaForest, the author, Mr. Carnival, or the department? The gentleman from Wabasha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Mr. Cummings could elaborate.
No, he can't.
I know he has the capacity to, Mr. Chair.
Depends on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Chair Draskowski. Any other questions? With that, Representative Garofalo moves that House File 182 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Chair Garofalo, Mr. Carnival, Mr. DeLaForest, and Mr. Cummings. Okay, item next, there are two Davids bills, House File 29 and House File 30. I will first move House File 29. And there is there anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? I do have Nan Madden, if you could please come down. Is there anyone else who wish to testify on this bill? Anyone that would wish to testify with concerns? Does the department wish to testify? Can you kind of do like you did the last one? Well, whatever. Okay. First of all, a brief description. You have it, members, in your pack. But Ms. Manzi, could you please kind of go through and tell me what the bill does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 29 provides that the Working Family Credit would no longer be funded in part with the federal TANF block grant. Up through now, the expansion in the Working Family Credit that occurred in 2000 has been funded with TANF funds. Every year, the Commissioner of Human Services and Revenue estimate the portion of the Working Family Credit resulting from the 2000 expansion that goes to an eligible population, and then they transfer that dollar amount from the TANF grant to the general fund to pay for that portion of the Working Family Credit. Last year's first tax bill, which provided for federal conformity and some other items that were added in the Senate, further expanded the Working Family Credit rates, and at the time no one considered that the statute that provides for a portion of the TANF fund to be transferred to offset an expansion in the Working Family Credit rates to the general fund might come into play under the Working Family Credit expansion included in that first tax bill from last year. That came to everyone's attention in the fall when the Commissioners of Human Services, Revenue, and MMB got together to figure out how much the transfer should be. And they saw that the language in the statute simply provided for any increase in the rates to be funded with TANF. At that time, the sitting chairs of the two tax committees, Representative Lincheski and Senator Scoie, sent a letter to the Commissioners of Human Services, Revenue, and MMB saying that such a thing had not been the intent of the first tax bill. And the November forecast and subsequently the February forecast carried only the transfer of the amount entailed by the expansion of the Working Family Credit in 2000 and not the much larger expansion of the Working Family Credit that happened in 2014. House File 29 provides that for tax year 2014, none of the 2014 Working Family Credit expansion would be funded with TANF. And beginning in tax year 2015, none of the Working Family Credit at all would be funded with TANF. The other bill you have before you, House File 30, simply goes back and says that only the 2000 expansion of the Working Family Credit is funded with TANF and the 2014 expansion is not funded with TANF. So House File 30 is just intended to clarify the intent of the legislature in the first tax bill from last year. House File 29 goes beyond that and undoes the funding of the 2000 working family credit expansion with TANF and has all of the working family credit funded with the general fund.
That's what I was going to say. Thank you, Ms. Manzi. And we have some testimony here on Ms. Nan Madden. Now, are you supporting this bill?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Talk as long as you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 29, which also includes the language of House File 30, and want to thank Representative Davids for bringing these bills forward. As you heard from Ms. Manzi, this is kind of a technical issue and includes some good cleanup language that simply would realign the funding sources for the working family credit. It doesn't make any policy changes to that credit. The bill is revenue neutral overall. It would use $47 million from the general fund to replace the same amount of TANF funding currently going to the working family credit. I think, as many of you know, the working family credit is Minnesota's version of the federal earned income tax credit. About half of all states have similar tax credits that build on the federal EITC's documented success in supporting work, reducing poverty, and improving the health and education of children. It is a credit that is only for households with earnings from work and is primarily for working families with children. So at the state level, the working family credit offsets a portion of the significant amount of sales taxes and other state and local taxes that these families pay. The reason we're having this discussion and the reason you have this bill before you is that a relatively small portion of the working family credit is currently funded by federal temporary assistance to needy families or TANF dollars. It's pretty unusual for a tax credit to be funded by sources other than the general fund, and we do so because of a decision made in the year 2000 that no longer fits the circumstances we're in today. TANF is the federal block grant that funds states' welfare-to-work programs, and federal law does allow states to use their TANF dollars on their state income tax credits. Minnesota is unusual in how much of our TANF we spend on tax credits. So this bill would fund the working family credit entirely by the general fund and would put those TANF dollars back into the TANF fund. The bill does not direct how those dollars would be used, those TANF dollars would be used. That's under the jurisdiction, that would be under the jurisdiction of the Health and Human Services Committee. I wanted to mention also this bill reflects recent recommendations of the state's bipartisan TANF Expenditures Task Force, which recommended to fund the working family credit entirely with the general fund. And I believe the committee members received a memo we prepared for that task force that goes into this topic in more detail. Thank you for considering this bill. I did want to note that we would strongly oppose removing the TANF dollars from the working family credit if those dollars were not replaced with general fund resources. We'd oppose funding this bill from a source besides the general fund surplus or using the freed up TANF dollars for purposes beyond the very low income families and children it's intended to reach. So thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. We'll go to the department, then we'll go to, if you could stick around, Ms. Mann. Please state your name, who represents for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to
the
committee.
Mr. Chair, there was, I think Ms. Manzi and Ms. Madden did a very good job at talking about these provisions. I wanted to say that House File 30, Mr. Chair, is a provision that mirrors what is in the department's technical bill. And so that House File 30 is something that we do support. As we went through session, we did, and as it related to the supplemental budget, as the supplemental budget was looking being put together, looking at various ways, looking at various ideas, and a provision mirroring House File 29 was included in the governor's supplemental budget. So, again, that has been included. It is public in many spreadsheets and budget pages. And so, you know, the language will be coming soon, but Mr. Chair, we do also support House File 29. You wrote some good bills, Mr. Chair, and we support them. So we look forward to working on this bill and other bills as they move through the legislature.
So, Mr. Cummings, what was your comments then on 29 itself? Is the administration or the department supportive of 29?
Mr. Chair, you know, we are supportive of 29 as it's in our technical bill, but we also note that there is conflict between the bills.
Mr. Cummings, I think we're talking two different bills. I believe your technical bill is House File 30.
Oh, I'm sorry. We are in favor of House File 29. Our House File 30 mirrors a provision in our technical bill, and since they are in conflict, Mr. Chair, I think that it would be fair to say that our position has grown from House File 30 to House File 29. Mr. Chair, throughout
that. Very good. Thank you. You know, anytime Ms. Madden supports one of my bills, it's a great day in Minnesota. It's kind of like Madden and Davids, or Davids and Madden, or Johnson and Johnson, or Kibble and Bits, or Smith and Wesson, or something. So, okay, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just think, you know, this shows how difficult it is when you have one complicated area of law trying to work with another complicated area of law under a different committee's jurisdiction, and I think sorting this out really makes it a lot cleaner both on the tax side and on the human services side. The TANF federal dollars have been frozen since before 2000, I believe. And so this would actually provide some opportunity in the Human Services Committee to deal with a frozen pool of federal funds for some critical priorities and help us avoid the problem that we ran into last time with just different committee staff and their different expertise inadvertently tripping across each other.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Drazkowski, Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who can answer the question, maybe Mr. Cummings, but the question would be, wouldn't this bill create an additional new liability for Minnesota taxpayers?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, and maybe Ms. Manzi could take a crack at this. Right now, the funds that backfill the working family credit, part of those dollars are TANF dollars. And so this bill, from what I understand, does not address how potential TANF dollars would be spent if not spent on the working family credit. So I don't, I think that this bill is merely realigning how the working family credit is financed. There may be other bills and other committees that talk about, you know, potential things that could be spent with TANF dollars, but I don't think that's located in this bill, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Manzi, to the Drazkowski question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, Ms. Templin had some exchanges with staff at Minnesota Management and Budget about what would happen if neither of these bills were enacted, and I think the way that the interplay between the funds work is that whether or not either of these bills are enacted, the full amount of working family credit obligations as entailed by the rates and the program parameters in statute would be paid from the general fund and partly from the TANF fund, and then all of the TANF obligations set in statute for the MFIP program and other things that TANF is used to fund would be paid. And if the total exceeded what was available in the TANF fund, then the general fund would pick up the difference. So I think that since these bills both shift money, or that's probably a bad word, they result in more money being available in the TANF fund for which there are not currently obligations of the TANF fund, If there were not any program expansions enacted for that money that would then remain in the TANF fund, I think what happens to that money then is it goes back to the federal government if we don't spend it. We don't get to carry it over and use it for other things. We can only use it for things that are specified under the federal welfare law. So it could go the other way where there would be less state spending, but I don't think there's any outcome of these bills that result in more state spending.
Return to Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Manzi, but for within the scope of the, or maybe the right word is purview of the areas that are under consideration with this bill, does not the action in the bill create more reliance on Minnesota tax dollars with the bill than currently?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, that's correct in that the general fund would be paying for the entirety of the working family credit. There would be the $23 million that would not be coming from the TANF fund, which is a federal block grant. Now, to the extent that the people who pay Minnesota taxes are also the people who pay federal taxes, it's sort of the same people. But to the extent that you want to put a little drop of paint or something on the different dollars and say where they came from, more of it would be with money that was paid by Minnesota taxpayers, and less of it would be with money that came from federal taxpayers.
I don't think it's legal to put paint on currency.
Well, it would be on the balance sheet.
Chair Draskowski.
So with that, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Manzi, what I think I heard is that we can do more tax cuts without the bill than we can with the bill. Is that correct?
Careful.
That's what we're here for.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, there would be more money in the general fund and less money in the TANF fund with either of these bills.
Chair Draskowski, that's a good answer.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm more confused than I was when I started, but thank you, Ms. Manzi.
Thank you, Chair Draskowski. Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Questions for members? Okay, with that, I will move that House File 29 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Ms. Madden, Mr. Cummings, and members. Tomorrow's agenda is robust here. We're going to finish up from last week, House File 89 and 1590. As we said, they were the department bills. We had a couple testifiers want to testify with concerns. I believe it was a Mr. Ines and a Ms. Cadoon from the chamber, I believe. And then we have a 1083, a Considine bill, 1176, a Hoppe bill, 1185, Atkins, 1423, Petersburg, 1544, Nash. So be here on time, members, and don't miss a bit of the excitement. Okay, next I'll move House File 30. And this one we're actually going to move and actually going to take a vote on. House File 30 is a bill that I will move. 30 is a bill that I will move to refer to the General Register. It's already been through HHS Finance, and, of course, we've talked about House File 30. But just a summary for the record, Ms. Manzi, on House File 30.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 30 changes the statute with regard to use of TANF funds for working family credit to reflect what I think everyone thinks was the intent of the working family credit expansion enacted in 2014.
Okay, and is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of the bill? Or anybody that has concerns on the bill? Maybe the department come down in just a second, make a few comments. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, House File 30 is, I believe, the bill, and I don't have my iPad in front of me, but that is the bill that is located in our technical bill. And so this is what as we were moving through session and all the spreadsheets that was laid out. This is what we believed was the practical effect of the legislation from last year, and we are merely making sure that that is clarified in statute. As I said in the testimony earlier, we have migrated to a position to say that House File 29 is more clearly articulates the administration's position, but House File 30 is definitely a needed correction, needed to ensure that the intentions of last year's tax bill are reflected as they were reflected in the spreadsheets as it passed last year.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Questions for members? Okay, I will renew my motion that House File... Oh, Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any questions on the bill, but Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering what we're doing here. Is this a vehicle bill?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Well, I think most chairs acknowledge Fairly when there's does. Vehicle bills, they're not mysteries. I always, in fact, announce them that way when I heard them. But, you know, I'm trying to understand. I thought I had heard that the technical and policy bills were vehicle bills. Is that true, too?
I learned this one the hard way, Chair Lincheski, back as a new chairman in 1999. I ran the committee. It was seven committees rolled into one. I didn't have any vehicle bills, and it really got kind of nasty towards the end without having those out there. So... my motto is you can never have too many vehicle bills, and yes, I will be using House File 1589, 1590. We have to have some things out there to be able to, when we negotiate with the Senate, to be able to bob and weave and move and things like that. So yes, that's and this House File 29 is showing up in other areas, the governor's technical bill and so forth. So I'd like to move this one to the general register Chair Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that's kind of my confusion. Needing three vehicle bills seems like you're projecting to not be very successful this year. But
Madam Chair, I think you would like five or six.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I just want you to know that your staff didn't reach out to us till yesterday, so we haven't prepared amendments, so, you know, we can do that on the floor. But, I'd just like to make a request in the future that, you know, people know in tax committee you almost never take a vote. And so if in the future folks could try to tell us you intend to vote so we could have time to draft amendments to get them before the committee, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Other questions for members? If not, I will move that House File 30 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Anything else from members for the good of the order? With that, don't stop believing good government all the time. We are adjourned.